Well, thank you very much. I'd like to just listen. Thanks. I hate when people do that at meetings. I always thought I'd like to try that at the public level. I've been a lot of places. I've never ever heard anybody read the traditions and have a favorite before. That was good. Or the guy in the front when they said that science will someday get us, maybe they'll find a way to get us to be normal drinkers. How could that happen? I mean, even if they fixed our physical craving, we'd screw it up again. Who wants to be a normal drinker? Right? I mean, they're so boring. So. I am going to just very, very briefly thank the committee. I don't like sometimes how people just get into thanking, but you know, every once in a while you go to a conference and they do everything they can to make you feel like you're welcome there, and this committee has done that in every way. And my wife is here with me, which is unusual. Normally what they do is they pick you up at an airplane, chuck you in a room, you deliver your talk, and in the morning they say, "Are you still here?" You know, there's nothing as useless Sunday morning as a Saturday night speaker. That is the truth. Alcoholics Anonymous is a place where we love to eat our young. And I got a chance to stand in your lineup. I wanted to find out what you were really like before you knew who I was. Interesting. I was lined up right into where the movie theater is, waiting to come into this meeting. And I didn't hear anybody being rude to anyone or any sort of pushing going. I just see a guy come down who was just about loaded. And he had the deal going, you know. And he said, "Hey, is this the Alcoholics Anonymous, the whole line, Alcoholics Anonymous?" Somebody said, "Yes, it is." And he said, "Will I get a suit if I join that thing?" Somebody. And then he got downstairs and said, "What losers, they all have to wear suits, you know, it's different coming here to talk, you know, in Nevada." I heard two people out front of the casino saying, "Where do you think they get the money to build all these beautiful buildings?" Yeah. Yeah, and everybody in the casino says, "Good luck, stupid." So anyway, my name is Marty Jeffrey, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm from a place in Canada called Red Deer, Alberta, so there's not a double speaker. Red D is not coming along with me. For some reason on the program, they made where I'm from anonymous as well. I don't know whether to be inspired or nervous at this point. Red Deer, Alberta is between two Canadian cities, one named Calgary and one named Edmonton, and Alberta is the province next to British Columbia. And I, among many, many Canadians, consider it an honor and a privilege to have neighbors like the United States of America. We love the United States of America in Canada. Glad that you're our neighbors. And we don't have to have any guns either. That's neat. When you got a neighbor the size of you guys, you know, who's going to attack you? So. Well, I'm an alcoholic, and that's a contraction of two words, alcoholism and addict. Alcoholic. And I mean, there's other stuff I'm going to tell you. It's getting deep so far, but that's... Somebody said to me the other day, "Where do you think the word alcoholic came from?" And I said, "Well, I think alcoholism is that situation that happens when you get so much alcohol in your blood. It's like botulism. And so people that drink to excess and have a lot of alcohol in their blood have alcoholism. Alcoholics are people that have no more alcohol in their blood." To get it, you have to stop. You see, it's kind of screwball. A lot of people don't understand how that works. But even people that return drinking say that, "I thought I was an alcoholic, but I guess I wasn't." And so they're back in alcoholism. We're alcoholics. Yeah. Now, some of you in the other room are saying, "Ick" already to this talk, but just try to get comfortable. By the way, Hi Starlight Room, I want to scream real loud and see if we can hear them. No. Glad you're there anyway. You know, there's a real, I don't know where it started, but somebody at a podium somewhere started saying that we say what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. You see, and that's not right. It's not right. What it is what we were like, what happened and what we were like now. What it was like doesn't really matter. And I hear a lot of people living in it. You know, like what it was like, what they were doing, what happened to me and yada, yada, yada. And what it's like now. I got money, I got friends. And you know, like, so what? I want to know, like, the we that I lived with back there is what I want to talk a little bit about first of all. And I can say, I think most alcoholics recognize that they had many voices in their heads. I had one group that was for destruction, mainly of me. And I had another group that was for survival. I had my father's voice in my head. I had a number of voices that used to talk to me. Some people think that's schizophrenia. But it isn't, because each voice is clear all at the same time. And they... I find the voices that I meet with usually like to shower at about the same time and start talking. It just depends on... This is why willpower will do you no good here, you 32 members. You think that you're going to come in and will yourself sober or something. The problem is... when the idiots in your head meet, it depends on who has the strongest presentation that day. And so if the voices that are saying, don't do it, if they're there, you don't do it. The next day you say, who's going to stop us? I mean, it's just, you're like a volleyball in your own life. And so this concept of not being able to hear and not being able to see when you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, really true, was for me when I first came here. And I guess... one of the other things that I want to say tonight before I really start saying anything tonight is that I didn't come here, I was brought here. And I was one of the big voices at 10 years sober for non-intervention. Well, about 15 years sober, I realized that I was an intervention. And I used to say to people, let them drink till they've had enough. They'll know when they've had enough, and then they'll come in, they'll want... Well, maybe, but maybe they'll die first. I know I would have. And so this person that brought me to this meeting, I want to talk about some of my sponsorship issues tonight. And I want you to know something, that what I say tonight, which sometimes sounds like criticism of my sponsor, is from a very deep place of love. I mean, you will understand quickly in this fellowship that the more they abuse you, the more they absolutely adore you here. That words like fathead and stupid and get in the car are terms of endearment. I love you. The ones that tell you you're okay are the ones that are killing you. Anyway, what we were like, I was... There's a step in the program that says that we're restored to sanity, and so it dawned on me one day, I must have been sane somewhere prior to when the disorder started. And so I started to map back through my life, and the last thing I remember that I was any semblance of normal was about 4 years old. It was the last time I ever remember kind of being part of Christmas. And then from then on, it was, what are these people doing? Like, my mother used to really annoy me, you know, breathing in, breathing out, breathing in, breathing out. I just wanted to, you know, these people that love and care for you, I like to kill the whole bunch of them. I hated that particular group of people. I prayed God every day until age 9 that I'd been adopted, and these weren't my real nuclear people. I had a brother, he turned out to be alcoholic, and this guy was a piece of work and maybe contributed to some of the fact that, you know, I started drinking at age 11. And I'm sure the next speaker will start at 7, and then we'll have a prenatal alcoholic by the end of the conference. But this guy, I mean, this is the kind of stuff he used to do. Christmas morning, he'd get up, and he'd move all the labels around on the Christmas presents. And I'd get, like, this is my fourth pair of socks, and he's getting a truck and an airplane, and I... What the hell's going on with this? But there is a God, there is a just God, because when I was about 11 years sober, there was a knock on my front door, and there he stood, the present snatcher. And he had everything he had in the whole world in a Safeway shopping bag. And he said, I don't know anybody, Marty, that can help me. I am out of control, and I just believe that you're the only person left on the earth that I trust. Would you sponsor me? And I thought, sure I will, you son of a bitch, get in the house. I'd be happy to sponsor you. And I had years of frustration taken out on him in his recovery. He's still sober today, damaged, but still sober. That's the kind of stuff that'll happen to you if you stay in Alcoholics Anonymous long enough. I had a lot of trouble with the word alcoholic. I knew that for a number of years that I had been drinking to change what I was. I knew that. I mean, I understood that if that's what alcoholism was, I probably had that. But I had no sort of conscious recognition of that, you know, like I knew something was wrong, and I knew other people were different than I was, but I didn't, you know, drinking seemed to me to be more, as the book says, a solution than any sort of a problem. It seemed like when I was drunk, even though I might be puking up chunks of pizza under a bed, I felt in control and felt out of control sober. And, you know, I've really come to understand that that first step is everything I need to know about me. It's every statement of everything that's wrong with me. I am powerless over alcohol, and I have to admit that my life has become unmanageable. That's the total statement of everything that's wrong with me. And I mean, I was the kind of a guy, I never would have come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I went out one night and I got drunk one more time. And you know how that goes? I had made a pledge to God, absolute pledge, that if you could just get me out of this little scrape that I'm in right now, Father, I will never drink again. And this happens when you're an alcoholic, and I don't know if this happens to earth people or not, but when you're an alcoholic, seemingly unsolvable things get resolved. And this day, I went from, I'm going to get fired. I mean, I went to a party, staff party. I was in the radio television business in those days. Went right to the food stand, picked up a pizza, walked right to the president of the company, and then stood back to see what the hell was going to happen next. You know, there's that sense of adventure when you're alcoholic. Like, I'm convinced there's something not attached in a full-blown alcoholic. Like, cause and effect. I was always surprised when people hit back. I was always surprised when people were mad. It was like, just screwing around. We're just having fun. And, I mean, I did a bunch of other stuff, and I woke up that morning, and oh my God, was I sick. I had that kind of, like, in-the-throat, nausea, dying, puking, sick, where you just honestly don't know if you're going to make it or not. Your heart is going in arrhythmia. You know that? Just as the vomit goes up. Somebody once said, you know you're alcoholic when you can puke over your own head and not get your hair wet. Oh, yeah. And I had that down, man. I was an in-the-car, wake-her-up kind of guy. And anyway, the phone was ringing. I could hear it off in the distance ringing. Way off in the distance. Anyway, I picked the phone up, and it was my loony sister. Man, she was nosy, this woman. And she had radar. Every time I was in trouble, she seemed to zone in. And she had the dumb question du jour, which was, how are you? How am I? You know, excuse me. Good. How are you? And she said the most remarkable thing. I'm absolutely convinced today that she had been one of you, because she asked that question. This is the right question. People say to me all the time, how do you approach somebody about quitting drinking? I say, ask them this question. She said, do you think you have a drinking problem? Thinking, drinking problem? Like, everybody I know is out cold before I ever stop drinking. I can swallow more liquor than anybody I know, no problem. Like, I'm thinking, where is this going? So she says, would you see a member of Alcoholics Anonymous for me? And I'm thinking, man, I'm not in enough trouble. Now I got to see some idiot from Alcoholics Anonymous and try and help him out. Oh. For a moment, I had a flash of Al-Anon recognition, just right, oh, not another alcoholic to help. And she sent over an alcoholic by the name of Dwayne. Now, Dwayne was a Norwegian. See, that doesn't offend a lot of you. It really offended me because I was married to a Norwegian. But that was good. But her father was a Norwegian. You know what I'm getting at here? And I'd go to pick her up, and he'd talk to me in Norwegian. You know, I'm not in this guy's car 2 minutes, and he's telling me he's Norwegian. I'm thinking, so what? Got a brush cut. I was 1976 when I had my last drink. I was 23. I am 23 years sober. I'm at the Equinox right now. And this guy at that time, Alcoholics Anonymous, the only place in the world you get a round of applause for saving your own ass. You know what I'm saying? It's true. This guy at this time is 13 years sober. 13 years. I'm thinking, you liar. First of all, anybody who was 13 years sober would be in a religious cult of some sort, not Alcoholics Anonymous. And number two, he told these bizarre stories. You know, I look back on this, and again, if you're new in the room and you're going to be doing a thing called a 12-step call, don't delay. Go out there right away. You can't screw it up. They can't hear you anyway. I often wonder where the two-year rule comes from. I mean, if Bill would have waited 2 years to 12-step Bob, you know, we'd all still be dead, right? Well, anyway, he takes me out in the car, and he starts telling me about breaking trains in the half to get to the bar and all this stuff, and he tells a story, and I tell a story, and it got worse and worse and worse. And eventually, of course, they've extracted most of your fifth step out of you, and he said the one thing that allowed me to come here and stay here, and that was this. He said, do you think that when you get in trouble most of the time, it's when you're drinking? I had never thought of that before. He said, do you suppose that, like, when you're not drinking, these things don't happen? I never really ever put that thought in my mind before. Not that you should quit drinking, not that, you know, you're a bad person or morally weak or any of that stuff. He said, do you think that if you didn't drink, you'd get in less trouble? I thought, interesting concept. Now, the other thing you can be absolutely sure of if you've got a new alcoholic on the line is that within 12 seconds of being with you, they're already changing their mind a number of times. I want what he has, I don't want what he has, I want what he has, I don't want what he has. Well, if he's going to say that, then I don't want what he has. You know, oh my God, look what he's doing now. Now I want what he has. No, I don't want to do that. You know. You know, you're laying out the profound things, and I'm trying to say, was I driving the car when we parked, or was he driving the car when we parked? Are we in my car? His car? I mean, I got stuff going on up there, nothing to do with anything he's talking about. But in the morning, he says, there's a meeting. This was a Sunday morning meeting called the Breakfast Group in a place called Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, Canada. And he said, I will pick you up for that meeting. It's at 10 o'clock in the morning, and so I'm an alcoholic. I left the house at 9. And he was in the car waiting for me. That's something you learn real quick. They're psychotic, and they also have telepathy. That's something you learn right away. And so we went to this meeting, and I would characterize this meeting like this. At 23 years old, to me, everybody in that room is over 100. They looked like they'd been sent out to be wrinkled. They were so old. And they had, I don't even know how to describe the way these people were drinking coffee. It was like compulsive. You know what I'm saying here? I didn't drink coffee. To me, coffee was a way to screw up a $5 drunk, was drink some coffee. And I figured any minute some of these seniors were either going to pass or pee on themselves, one of the two. This meeting is in the back of a restaurant, and I'm going through this restaurant, and I'm saying to people as I pass, I'm not in Alcoholics Anonymous. And finally he came over to me and says, would you shut up? You're embarrassing me. I just thought anybody that went to that back room was instantly marked with a big A on their forehead. I didn't know what Alcoholics Anonymous was, but it sounded suspicious. The anonymous part sounded suspicious. I thought they were all hiding. They're in shame for what they did. I had no idea that anonymity is more to do with protecting us from our super egos than it is to do with us being ashamed of any particular thing that we've done. And I go into this room, and there they are, right? Geriatric miracles, every one of them. And were they happy? Holy God, were they happy? They're going up and down some 12 stairs or some damn thing. I couldn't understand what they were talking about. But the more stairs you did, the better you got. And there was one unfortunate who was stuck on the 12th or the fifth stair. And there was quite a bit of discussion about that fifth stair. One of them said, if you don't get off that fifth stair, you will get drunk. And I'm thinking, so where's the fifth stair? Let's get at her. Yep. Yeah, that was a big meeting for me, I'll tell you. I could hardly wait for that thing to end. It was just, and anyway, at the end of it, the president or whatever the hell he was at the front of the room says, and this was the most remarkable thing I'd heard anyone say at that meeting to that point, he says, if you want what we have, I start looking. God, they've got no hair. I know. You stick around anywhere long enough, you go out like you came in, no hair, no money, no teeth. But they're 100 and then they can't drink for the rest of their lives. Do you want what we have? Oh, absolutely I do. Sure, I want that. I'm thinking, what were those choices again? Oh, yeah, here it is. Death, insanity, or join them. I'll take death. I mean, I'll take death. Oh, man. That thing, and you know, they never leave. They haven't had enough coffee. They want to have some coffee. You want to stay and have a coffee after the meeting? I'm thinking, where the hell are you going to put it? You know, I'm figuring they've all got to have colostomies or some damn thing to be. It's incredible the amount of coffee that these people drink, inhale. Oh, man. I think some of them were, you know, that's that. I'll tell you one piece of information I'm glad I didn't have when I got here was the vanilla in the eyeballs routine last night. Oh, yeah. Yeah, and the spray net up the throat. It sounded attractive to me. I don't know about you. A yellow couch with blood and urine. Man, this is living. We get outside of the meeting after what seemed like an interminable amount of time. And he says to me another remarkable question. What did you think of the meeting? So, but I'm an alcoholic. I'm not stupid. I know if I say I didn't like the meeting that I'm going to get a lecture. So I says to him, I loved it. I almost wish I was alcoholic, I swear to God. That was interesting stuff. And whatever you people are doing there, I am more than happy. If you need money, you got to understand, we had not a pot. We had nothing. If you need money or if you need me to get you on the radio for some publicity or whatever you need, Dwayne, you just call me, man, because what you guys are doing, good stuff. And he said, yeah, right. Anyway, so I figured that's that. I went home, and my wife is here. She'll testify. I came home from the meeting. I said to her, I have been at a zoo. You wouldn't believe what's going on at this place. And I told her, and she went, no, no. And I said, you know, do you think I'm an alcoholic? No. She said, you know what I think? I think you shouldn't drink so much. Problem solved. Well, was I surprised when he came to pick me up for another meeting? Because I thought I'd been pretty clear, you know? Well, anyway, I didn't want to offend him because he's Norwegian and they get rough. We got in a car, we went to another meeting, and this one's called the Mustard Seed Group. And we go into the Mustard Seed Group, and there's all the same guys from the early morning meeting, and there's a couple of women. Hookers, I figure. Well, you know, what would a nice girl be doing at Alcoholics Anonymous? That's what I'm thinking. Because I was a saint myself, you know. So at the end of the meeting, they'll say sometimes, does the newcomer have anything to say? And I said, oh, yeah, I got something I'd like to ask. So they said, well, go ahead. And I said, are you two hookers? And, yeah, Ruth said, no, we were never hookers, Marty. But what we would do sometimes if we got really drunk is we'd pick up an anemic little turd like you. And if he was very good, we'd show him a good time. And if not that, we'd just throw him out of the car, you know. So now I hate the women in Alcoholics Anonymous. I hate the men in Alcoholics Anonymous. I hate Alcoholics Anonymous. I know there's nothing for me. All they've got is these stupid 12 little steps. I could have written them myself, I'm thinking. God, anybody could do that. And I got out in the car and I says to him, you know what, Dwayne, I don't want to go to any more meetings. He said, so what? I said, so what? So what is I have rights? He said, you don't have any rights. Where did you ever hear that? I said, I've got rights. I'm a Canadian. He said, you're an alcoholic. Alcoholics have no rights. And he said, I have people all over this town. I know where you go and I know what you do. We are everywhere. That's why we're anonymous. We're watching you all the time. And he said, if you decide to drink, you phone me right away and I'll give you your first beer. And then I will bust every bone in your body. I said, why do you talk to me like that? And he said, it's really simple. He said, I know if you drink, you're going to get hurt, and I don't want you hurt by strangers. It's really simple. I want to do it myself. Yeah. See, you know, how do you know what you don't know you don't know? I had a way of solving things all of my life. It went in a kind of a circle. I started here, I went there. Alcohol was involved somewhere in the middle. That's how it always turned out. How do you know what you don't know you don't know? I mean, it's so crazy. And so I did not know I was powerless over alcohol because I took alcohol. It always did that to me. When I was 11 years old and I took that first drink, I was in a bathroom. It was Loganberry wine. And from the first time I took that first drink, I knew that I was... For the first time, I swear to God, the words that I've got to describe it are this. I was all in one place, all at the same time, for the first time ever in my entire life. That's what happened to me. And I got on my bicycle, and I knew I could ride faster than any person in history. And I got on this thing, and I just let it rip. And I was probably doing between 400 and 700 miles an hour when I hit the truck. And I went off the back of the bicycle, and I did a little skin donation. And I remember thinking, as I was caroming off of the pavement, this came through my mind, as it does every alcoholic's mind, this doesn't hurt. Nothing hurts. I can go home and beat Michael up. Everything just came into focus, and I went home, and my mother, and I did not come from an alcoholic home. You need to understand that. I came from a Christian home. This is a breeding ground for alcoholics, because they don't know anything. And my mother opened the door, and there it was, 11 years old, knee out of its pants, blood all over it, lying. You know, she said, are you drunk? I had two. I'm 20 years old. I'm still saying, I had two. That's it. It's the only lie you get when you start drinking. And so she threw me in the bathtub. I puked. I found out, you know, that Loganberry wine goes down this dark purple, comes up this foamy pink. Life was good. Could hardly wait to get to school in the morning and tell all the kids the transition, the transformation that had happened to me. Could not get one other kid in grade 6 remotely interested in drinking. And so I did what the book says. I started to look for lower companions. You got to do that until you finally become a lower companion. And by grade 7, I was kind of an alien in my own class. In grade 8, I didn't really know the kids very well. In grade 9, I was a stranger there. And that's how that went. And so in that car that night when he said I didn't have any rights and that he was going to look after me, immediately what happened to me was I felt the same powerlessness I'd felt all of my life. And you know, I'll tell you something about powerless people. Powerless people blame other people. You know, we confuse resentments with thinking. It's not thinking. You know, we try and find out, whose fault is this anyway that I'm in this trouble? And then if I can attach to that person, I can spend the rest of my time not focusing on me, but focusing on them and what they did to me, and my powerlessness is justified. And then I can get juiced at them, and I can do this and that. And you know what? That night in that car, that powerlessness, it was the blackness and the madness was all around me. I had the Norwegian hitman who had taken a personal interest in me. This idiot introduces me to a guy at the meeting who had murdered his best friend. Told him where I lived. If you want what we have, and you're willing. You see what I'm saying? You guys aren't exactly catch of the season when we first come in here. And so the powerlessness over the alcohol made my life unmanageable, but the sobriety compared to the drinking, the sobriety was absolutely untenable. I never ever got drunk once to get drunk. And I hear all sorts of alcoholics contradict me and say, I don't agree with that. But I'm telling you something. I never went out to get drunk. I went out to not get drunk. I went out to get a buzz. I went out to get comfortable. I went out to get different. And we shouldn't tell newcomers it's going to get better. We should say it's going to get different just for a period of time. Because it just doesn't get better. It's like the Australian dung beetle. It rolls manure until the ball is so big it can't push that crap anymore, so it drills a hole in the middle of it and lives in it. And yeah, you get up every day and it stinks. And you got a shitty outlook on everything. And then what they say to you is, I never remember it smelling like this when I drank. No, that's right. You weren't awake long enough to have it smell like that when you drank. You know, you weren't conscious long enough to see what you pushed behind that wall that now has to be dealt with. And so when he said to me, I will keep you sober. For 90 days, you're not going to drink immediately. I started thinking, you are my problem. And I was able to focus on him, and I started thinking, in 90 days, I am going to kill you. And this is sort of like newcomer gratitude stuff. I'm going to kill you. I'm going to burn your car. And I wanted to kill his dog. He had a dog that was like 100 years old. He was like all the people at the meetings. You know? Its name was Tinker. Tinker, guy's 6'4", 280 pounds, got a dog named Tinker. And you'd knock on the door, and you'd hear, like that. And he'd say, and this was the big Saturday Night Entertainment, he'd say, smile, Tinker, and the dog would go, I'm 23 years old, we're over at Dwayne's watching Tinker smile Saturday night. I don't know about you. It wasn't what I kind of had in my mind for Saturday night. 90 days was forever. 90 days was a jail sentence. And I swear to God, the only thing that kept me sober was the fear of what he would do to me if I drank. That's the truth. That is God's truth. And, you know, it's an amazing thing. But by the time I went through those 90 days, something happened. And it happens to anybody that'll go to enough meetings. They say if you drag your mind to enough meetings, eventually it'll open. And that was what my experience was. And you see, if the problem is that I'm powerless over alcohol, and the problem is that my life has become unmanageable, I am going to go in the same circle over and over. The unmanageability is going to drive me back to the powerless nature of the drinking, and so it goes. And unless somebody breaks that cycle, how do you get out of there? And you see, the whole solution to my problems in the second step, where it says that we have come to believe that a power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity. And you know, I'll tell you what, sanity for me today means being whole. Being good in my mind and my body and my family and my community. You know, like being whole. That's what being sane is. The first vestige of that I had was that at some point, somehow, some way, I didn't want to drink anymore. And I can't explain that to anybody. I just, all of a sudden, I did not want to drink. People say to me sometimes, don't you wish you could drink? No. I don't even want to drink. In fact, I get with people drinking and they make me nervous. They seem like they're out of control. They're going to flip any minute. I can still remember thinking like that. I don't want to be around people that are drinking. I like to be around people that are thinking. Row 15. Uh-uh. No. So here's what I had to do. I had to, over a period of time, let go of some old ideas. I had some ideas that went like this. If there's a God, I'm going to hell. So I can't accept that there's ever going to be any sort of a higher power or a God, because I know that a scumball like me is never going to be forgiven. I remember calling Dwayne in about my 120th or something day of sobriety and saying, Dwayne, I can't give my life and my will over to the care of God. He said, why not? I said, because if I give my life to God, Dwayne, God will send me to Africa as a missionary. And he said, what do you think God would do with an ass like you in Africa? You know, as screwed up as I was, I had to think, good point. It's a good point. It didn't come on me all at once that my solution was going to be from a power outside of myself. In fact, the first thing I had to accept was how utterly defeated I was. This is the paradox of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the only place in the world where they say, look, if you'd really like to win at this thing, give up. It's upside down and backwards. Most of the stuff in here is. They say no dues or fees, and then they pass a hat. What's that about? I, I remember the day that it finally dawned on me, oh my God, I'm alcoholic. I was driving a car. It was like 94 days sober or something. I'm going down a freeway, and all of a sudden it came across me with such finality. I had a terminal disorder that only a spiritual experience could relieve, and I'm thinking, oh, I'm screwed. Oh my God, I'm really an alcoholic. I'm one of them. I'm going to get tinker the whole thing. Oh my God. So I phoned Dwayne, and I said, Dwayne, God, oh my God, I'm an alcoholic. He said, holy God, what brought you to that conclusion? I said, I don't know. I just know I'm an alcoholic, and if I drink, I die. And he said, Marty, treasure this advice for the rest of your life, okay? He said, people that are alcoholic can bath in whiskey. Just don't put it in your mouth. That's it. Don't take the first drink, and you won't die from the ninth drink. Click. That was Dwayne's sort of like, we're done talking sound. That wasn't good enough for me. I went to an associate's of Dwayne's. This guy was, he had gray hair. You know those guys that look like they're out of a soap opera? His name was Bob. He's got like the $1,500 suit. And I said, Bob, you know, you're so much brighter than Dwayne. Did you talk about your sponsor behind his back? Oh, I always did. I said, Bob, you know, tell me what this alcohol is. And he says, well, Marty, Bob was very official. He said, Marty, what you're suffering from is a genetic disorder centering in the hypothalamic information control center of your brain. And this is made worse by your liver's inability to metabolize alcohol without producing acetaldehyde, which, mixed with dopamine, produces tetrahydroisoquinoline. That's a nasty combination, Marty, given the narcissistic, egocentric core of your personality, which is driven at times by feelings of omnipotence, which tend toward their own integrity despite cognitive dissonance and stimulus augmentation. Yeah. I said, what does all that mean? He said, your drinker is broke. Go back to Dwayne. You know, Bob taught me a lot of lessons. I remember one time I was selling clothing, and Bob stopped in the store, and I said, geez, I hear Jake C. got drunk. He said, when were you talking to Jake? And I said, I wasn't. I just heard that. He said, so then what you're really telling me is you're a malicious, snotty little gossip. Oh, yeah. Well, I said, no. He said, oh, yeah. Yeah, that's exactly what you are. And he said, I don't associate with gossip, so see ya. I walked away. I don't know. You know, Dr. Silkworth talked about deflation at great depth. Deflation at great depth is that thing that happens to you when you've got people that love you so much they won't lie to you anymore. And that they are, you know, ready to point out some of your shortcomings. It's a loving thing that's done sometimes. It's about the fact that if you're like I was and you're in a fog, you know, the fear of the obligation and the guilt, and you've got the repetitive solution going, the same thinking, trying to solve the same old problems, then you've got to have some people that have the wherewithal not to worry about you rejecting them. These are the people that will save your life. If you've got some crusty old fart in your sobriety right now that says things to you that you don't like, but you know at the same time that there's some sort of a truth in them, never let them go. They are absolutely invaluable to you. Because, you see, if the first step is the problem and the second step is the solution, then what it's asking me to do next is the really hard piece. And what it's asking me to do next is simply the most difficult thing alcoholics have to do. Make a decision. Make a decision. You know, there's a guy in 1936 wrote a book called Think and Grow Rich, and he had interviewed a number of millionaires in 1936. And without exception, people that became wealthy all made decisions quickly and changed them very slowly, if ever. People who never acquired anything made decisions very slowly and changed them frequently. It's just non-alcoholic, alcoholic, right? I made decisions every day, but I could never stay with them. And you see, what these people, this group of crusty old-timers said to me in those days was really simple. It's that you are too sick to make a decision. We'll make the decision for you until such a time as you get your brain reinstalled, and then you can start to make some decisions. They said somewhere around 15 to 20 years sober. I was brought up in the old school where they said you will not quit your job, you will not change your relationship, you will not do anything life-altering for the first 2 years. And we'd be really interested to hear how much that upsets you, because we don't give a rip. And I mean, I did those things, and if I would not have done those things, you see, if you change so many things in your life, and at the same time you're trying to change how you think, it's just like trying to get your feet down on sand that's moving around. At least keep something consistent in your life. And when you make a decision in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you're going to succeed at this thing, I'm going to tell you right now, it's an irrevocable decision. It's a decision that can't be changed. It's a decision to turn your life and your will over to the care of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a decision to do the steps. You see what I'm saying? Step three is nothing more than saying, that's it. This is the line. It's from this day, I change here. I might make some different choices in my sobriety, but the decision is to not take the first drink. The decision is that I turn it over and I start to become teachable, and I start to allow other people to say to me the things that I've allowed no one ever to say to me. And the first thing it says is that although that's a powerful decision, it says if it's not followed immediately by action, that the effects are not lasting. And you know, that's true. And so I started to do this thing called a step four, a searching and moral inventory. Bill's way of saying, like, get in there and find out what's underneath the surface. I'll tell you why you got to do a step four. It's because if you squeeze an orange, nothing but orange juice comes out. No. Probably you're thinking, he's really gone this time. But if you squeeze an orange, nothing comes out but orange juice, because there's nothing in the orange but orange juice. You get an alcoholic in recovery who has all of these things just below the surface, and you squeeze them, and what comes out is not sweet. What comes out is not predictable. What comes out is not what the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, and people that think that circumstances somehow shape their sobriety are exactly upside down and backwards. Bill said that character building was never a desirable thing for alcoholics, but in reality, it's the character that shapes the things around you. It's an inside job. No outside change is permanent unless there's inside change. That's what step four is about. So that when they squeeze, and it will squeeze, because this is life. This is not a dress rehearsal. This is life. It starts. People will run into your children. I met a woman not so long ago. I was called to go and talk at a conference to fill in for somebody. You know, the hand of God. And I had this unbelievable growing blackness around me that if ever anybody's kid was going to get killed by a drunk driver, it would be my oldest son, Donovan. You know why? Because this kid had never drank. This kid was a perfect student. This kid was the best dad I ever had. I mean, he was just born old. And I thought, if anybody, you know, was going down the highway and some drunk idiot would kill him, it would be my Donovan, because that would be God's way of getting even. And this thing started to obsess me. And I went to this meeting this night, and there was this woman there, and what had happened to her was absolutely incredible. She had a son who was killed in a rollover on a tractor. 1 year to the day that that boy died, her second son went downstairs and hung himself. The following day, after she'd phoned her mother and father to come home from Florida for the funeral, the next son went downstairs trying to mess around. I guess it's not even an uncommon thing in suicide, trying to figure out how the older brother had done it, and he too hung himself. She buried three children in the space of 1 year. And I said to her, how do you live through that? And she said, you know, the reality is, Marty, you don't live through that. You have to come out another way. You have to, first of all, understand that all the kids are God's kids. They're only on your bus for a period of time. He will take them home when he decides to take them home. This is how it is with your pigeons and your babies. They are on your bus for a period of time. They are only there for you to learn from. It is a blessed gift. But we cannot decide the outcome. You see what I'm saying? She was from the inside squeezed at a place where most of us would have broken. And all that came out of her was sweetness, because all she does now, her entire life, is to carry this message to people about how to survive that level of tragedy. And I know that some of you are in this room tonight and you've got some really heavy luggage. And you come to these conferences and you see these people flown in, fed too much, rooms paid for, aren't they having fun? And you're dying out there. And here's the big secret of Alcoholics Anonymous for every single person that's ever got this program. It starts from the inside. It starts in that step four. It says those of us who are not thorough about this step usually return to drink. And there's a reason why. It's because I have a picture of how things are in my life. And I will always solve to the strongest picture. It's interesting, you know. I talk to alcoholics, and they have got a reshaped idea of who they are. And everything they move toward is about success and happiness and love and giving. And then you have some other ones that still have this picture of getting and keeping and selfishness and self-centeredness. And everything that comes to them is scarcity and lack and poverty and anger and greed and negativity. And you say, why is it some people are able to not live like that? And it's so clear to me now. In that chapter, it says, some of us tried to hold on to old ideas and the result was nil until we let go. Absolutely. So we need to find out, what are the old ideas? That's what the step four thing was all about for me. You know, I had one of those sponsors that said, did I see you putting money in the collection plate, Marty? Because we don't accept outside contributions. You haven't done your step four and five yet. Why? See, I don't know about you, but I think sometimes that we make it's almost like we're begging people to come in Alcoholics Anonymous. This is the most exclusive club in the world. People are dying to get in here. If you are ever to understand, you know, sometimes it comes to you how rare a bird you really are, how few people actually ever to get to hold on to this thing, sobriety, ever get to have the blessings you have. It's a minuscule percentage of the people that are dying from alcoholism. And yet here we sit. And we don't have an attitude of gratitude. And it's because just below the surface in many of us, there are these unresolved things. And you know, as long as you remain in that powerless state, blaming people, places, institutions for things that are going on in your life, you will never be free of it. And so I went into this step four, and what I did was I listed every person in my head. I just took a foolscap paper and I just started writing. I couldn't believe it. I should have just done a list of the one person I wasn't pissed off at. It would have been quicker. I was mad at everybody. Everybody had control of me. I didn't. The book is so right. People, places, institutions had control of me. I thought I was mad at them and teaching them a lesson, and they were controlling me. I was avoiding places because people there, not going to meetings because so-and-so is chairing, yada, yada. You know what? You start to write all that crap down, and you start to see how it affects you. And you start to understand there's that, like for me, old Bob used to say, Marty, at 7 o'clock, get in the chair and read page 62. And I think, why on earth does he get me to read this all the time? And it said, selfishness and self-centeredness, we think, is the root of our problem. Driven by 100 forms of fear, selfishness, self-seeking, self-centeredness, we step on the toes of our fellows. They retaliate, seemingly without provocation. But we invariably find it was us who set it in motion. I think, what a strange thing for him to get me to read all the time. Because I'm the one persecuted here. I'm the one it's done to. You know, I was a person that believed humility was more to do with humiliation. I thought there's no way I could ever be arrogant because I hate my own guts. You know? You go into that step four and you start to mine this stuff up. And I see people do it all the time. They'll get through a step four and then they don't want to do a step five. It's like gathering up glad bags full of garbage and then leaving it in your front room to really fester. You know, let's get it up so it really stinks and then just leave it there. And then say, I don't think this is working for me, you know. You want to go to another person and you want to talk to them about the nature of the wrongs, because it is within the nature of the wrongs that I started to understand some really amazing dynamics. Number one, and most of all, what is wrong with me is a very small thing. Not everything's wrong with me. The things that are wrong with me kind of narrow down into selfishness, self-centeredness, my insecurities, and my fears. If I could just start to think in a positive way, a whole bunch of stuff starts to happen that's good. It's so simple to do, it almost eluded me. And so now I sit in the world, and the world starts to get negative, and I start to think negative, and I've learned from a friend of mine, a member of Alcoholics Anonymous named Bob, I just say, next thought, please. I'm not going there today. You know, I start listening to that stuff in my head, and it's all this powerless crap that I want to start blaming people or places or things, and I just say, next thought, think something happy. Start focusing on how much oxygen there is in this room. It's a good thing, believe me. I used to be so insecure as a kid because I had a big nose, and then I realized, hell, I'm getting more air than you are. There's something positive in almost everything. You know, I'm one of those people that came out of the step five, and I recognized that I didn't have that thing done. I had done it to the best of my ability, but at the time I didn't have enough ability. At the time I didn't have enough honesty to stand in the center of that and really look headlong to the things that were really causing me trouble, because, you know, I didn't want to get rid of some of them. I did not want to get rid of some of the defects of character that gave me what I thought was pleasure. Actually, it was creative avoidance. What I was doing was just substituting some really crappy stuff and beating myself out of everything that I absolutely loved. This is the most amazing thing. The Greeks had a word for it called skotoma. It's a blindness that you get, and it's only partial, but you can just see some of what's going on in your life, and that's where I was. And I thought, man, if I let that thing go, I mean, that's the only thing that really makes me happy right now. You know, hating people. being totally, like I'd see people that had all these friends. And, you know, Stan, my sponsor, used to say to me, Marty, go home and pray this. Pray to be a guy on the block, a friend among friends. Just pray to be just absolutely ordinary so that you can have everything that this program has to offer you. Just be a part of, not in front of, not on top of, just a part of. The greatest blessing in the world is being a face in a crowd. You know, I don't understand that. I remember going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and say to Dwayne, everybody's staring at me. He said, Marty, when you walk in a room, you have no idea how little they all care. It was like 10,000 pounds came off of my back. I don't know where you are in this room today, but what I learned was this, that when I'm thinking that about them, I don't have to worry because they're thinking, everybody's staring at me. You know, the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous where you feel most apart from and different than and lonely, what they taught me to do is go and find the other loneliest son of a gun in the room, put my hand out, and you get a friend for life. Alcoholics Anonymous is about becoming a leader servant. You'll find the ones that you most want to be like are the ones who choose to think the positive things. They haven't got everything good happening in their lives. They just say next to all of the negative things that are going on in their lives. And I came through that step five, and I was entirely ready for just a moment in time to have God remove all these defects of character. And then I got to work removing them. Hello? I was entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character, and then I got about removing them. That doesn't work. You know, I got involved in the church. I got so spiritually minded, I was of no earthly good. I used to go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and silently pray for all of you because you smoked and swore. One day I was with Dwayne, and he told a dirty joke, and I said, you know, I don't have to listen to that. And he got mad, and he slammed the car into the curb, and he said, listen, he said, I want to tell you something, you pompous little ass. He said, I have more spirituality in my rear end than you have in your entire body. And I said, how would you know a thing like that, Dwayne? And he said, because you don't have any peace. And he said, you know what, get out of the car. Get out, go die, drink, don't care. You're out of Alcoholics Anonymous. Get out. Man. You think AA is the last house on the block? I'm afraid not. I went to church the next day, and the pastor said to me, when we're in a congregation, Marty, and we're praying, who's the audience? I said, the people. He said, no, God. He said, I watch you Sunday after Sunday, and I know there's something wrong. And what it is that you don't understand when we pray that what we're doing is we're all praying together, and whatever your religious beliefs are, don't let my Christian thing get in the way here, but however you're relating to your higher power, that's who's the audience. And I went, oh. And he said, you know what I really would appreciate you doing? I wish you'd go back to AA. Now I'm kicked out of church. And I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous. There's an old boy named Jeff Charlebois. He'd been sober about a year longer than it took the crust's earth to cool. I mean, 31 years or something. He'd been around forever. And I walked past Jeff, and he said, there but for the grace of God goes God. Yeah, I had a lot of pain. I don't know about deflation at great depth for you, but I had a thick skin and a hard head and a really bad heart. I had an attitude of, you know, like, let me stay with everything that's wrong with me and just make me comfortable. And, you know, step six is the first time in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous where you actually admit that the second half of the first step and the first part of that first step are really true. You are powerless. There is no way out. I remember being at a meeting and Tommy I was speaking and the speaker finished and I thought, oh man, like I'm having an LSD experience. Somebody must have drugged my drink or something. You know, I was like all that stuff going on. Any druggies in the group here? And I look at the woman across me, her makeup's all running down her face, and holy cow. So I rip across the highway to where I was staying in a motel, and Shirley was in bed. She said, what's wrong? And I said, you know, like all new alcoholics do, I shared with my spouse. I said, shut up. That's what that was really like at our house for a long, long time. AA out here, Mr. Nice Guy, in the house, not like that. Anyway, I go in the bathroom, I get on my knees, I open the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and it says you have a reprieve. And it's a contingent condition. Now, you know what that means? It means it may happen and it may not. God's got an if. It says, if you maintain your spiritual condition. I couldn't get through to that. I didn't understand what a spiritual condition was. But I'll tell you one thing that did happen is that at the end of that experience, I went quiet. I didn't have the drug thing happening anymore. I just went quiet. And I slept that night. And in the morning, I made a decision that I was going to go to my group's big book study, even though I knew they didn't know anything. And I decided that I would sit at the back of the big book study and I would not contribute, even though I knew everything. And they were reading on the 14th page where Bill was in the hospital, and he talked about the fact that Ebby had emphasized that he had to give it away. And he said that this is how we grow our spiritual condition, and I understood for the first time in Alcoholics Anonymous, your spiritual condition is your service. That we grow spiritually through service. And that as long as I was willing to maintain that spiritual condition, that I was going to be okay. And that's how that was. When I came to step 6, what I suddenly understood was that I was entirely ready not to live like that anymore. I was entirely ready not to have those old ideas anymore. That I was entirely ready to let that go. And then I did that thing that it talks about in step 7. This is the first time that the siren went off when I said that. If you want me to stop, you could just say stop. Does anybody know what to do? So in conclusion, can anybody verify with the hotel if that's a test or whatever?
It's probably just a test, sir.
Just a test? Can you get them to stop testing? Sometimes when you hear the truth in AA, some of you newcomers, like, you'll hear sirens. I'm serious. A big chunk of truth will hit you, and it's just like that. So let me sum up by saying this, that by the time I got into that seventh stair, that what I recognized was that humility for me at this point is to clearly understand that I am not going to fix the nature of my wrongs. I hear this all the time, and you know, like, God bless you if it works for you. It did not work for me. I spent a lot of my life trying to forgive me. I don't have the power to forgive me. It is outside of my control to forgive me. I'm the perpetrator, for God's sake. How do I forgive me? But what I couldn't do was accept that someone else could forgive me. It's an acceptance of forgiveness that there's power. And I said to Dwayne one time, I just don't believe God's going to forgive me. He said, with the snotty little sins you have, you nothing, zero little garden variety alcoholic, you're more powerful than God. Who the hell do you think you are? Boy, I felt so forgiven. Like that. And you know, I mean, I've spent the first part of the whole program talking about me. It's the same old thing. Why people don't want to do step 4, I can't understand. It's an opportunity where you talk about nothing but your bloody self. That's our favorite subject. You know, the old adage is true, I'm not much, but I'm all I think about. That is step 4. Billy Graham said the smallest package in the world is a human being wrapped up all in themselves. That is step four. Step five, let it go. And then in that step six, in that wonderful healing, you know, I had a character defect for 35 years. And I tried and I prayed and I tried every form of psychology. I tried every form. And believe me, I'm read in those things. I understand those things. I could not rid myself of this thing. It drove me insane. And February the 6th of this year, in Chicago, Illinois, at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, it was removed. I don't even know why, but it's gone. And it's been gone every day since then. I don't know when that miracle takes place, but I know if you're not ready to do it, and if you're not ready to be entirely okay with the fact that those things will be removed, it's a tougher ride. You don't have to do it. You have to accept it. This is a program of surrender, not victory. This is about the Confederate Army laying the flag on the table and saying, we surrender. It doesn't mean you got any more moves and any more troops hitting in the ditch. It's over. And when you say to your higher powers, you understand that God of yours, I surrender, he will in his time start to take these things from you, and all I have to do is be willing to be grateful when the things are removed. Isn't that an amazing reality? And then on the eighth, ninth steps, I start to go out and I start to try and fix things that I've caused in other people's lives. You know, I love that story in the book about the guy that comes out of the cellar and says the trees are flat, and he says, Ma, the wind stopped blowing. That is me. That is the alcoholic that goes out after you've got sobriety and you've got wealth and you've got all those things that have happened to me. And I go into, and I don't want to go and tell anybody, you know, I was wrong. It was me. This was my place in all of that stuff. And I can go out and start not making amends to me. Go out into the world and start making amends to other people, cleaning up the wreckage. Because if I will not do that, I will not move closer to this power that's greater than myself. And there's nothing I want more than that. Like, I'm really starting to understand at a very deep level, more every day, that if I continue to be grateful for the things that are around me, I will move closer and closer to the substance of the entire universe. And that all I will have to do from this point on is just learn how to have that sort of a connection with the power. I can have anything I want. And all I have to do is just try and find a few other people who want the same thing and share that freely and openly with them. And that's what I'm trying to do with my life at this point. I told you I was going to tell you what we are like now. And this is just like right out of a fairy tale for me. I told you I stopped drinking when I was 23. We had nothing. We were bankrupt in every single area of our lives. And we were angry with one another, Susie. Susie and I, Shirley, my wife, Smokey, Goldie. I call her all kinds of names, so that's the only girl I've got, I promise. We were angry. We found in like 20 or 21 years of sobriety, suddenly we were at a place where we had to sort of meet and fall in love all over again. That happened. I went home and tried to re-enter my children's lives after a successful business career. Anybody out there who's working day and night to make a whole pile of dough and you're missing your family, tell you what, just from a friend, don't do that anymore. Because I came home one day and there's this 6-foot-tall guy standing in our front hallway, and it turned around, it was my son. And I thought, God, she must be feeding these kids manure or something. It's just huge. And I had missed that kid growing up. And then I found myself in his late teens re-entering his life as his father and his friend. And I mean, this is a kid that I just absolutely loved, but I got so busy I couldn't hear and I couldn't see in my house anymore. It's just another form of doing the deal. This is the kid that at 9 years old came to me and said, how do you join Alcoholics Anonymous? And I said, why? And he said, because I don't want to drink. I said, well, just don't drink. He said, you can do that without joining? I said, yeah, you can. He's 24 years old today, and he has 6 months more sobriety than I do. Never drank. I know. It's a miracle. I have a middle son named Chad. I think he's drank a couple of times and doesn't have much interest in it. And then we had Beelzebub, my daughter. 16 years old, got herself a bottle of vodka. And just got absolutely hammered. It passed out down the basement and the whole deal. And what I want to tell you is that because of Alcoholics Anonymous and the friends and the fact that you take time with my kids and they hear you and they see you and they love you, is that after a couple of those episodes with her, that behavior stopped. She today doesn't drink. She's got a partner who's got juvenile diabetes, and he can't drink. And they just bought their first home. They're 20 years old. Bought their first home with their own money. I don't know how you explain that. Shirley and I had a beautiful ranch, and she ran thoroughbred racehorses, and we've been gifted with money and travel, and I get to do this a lot. I've been all over the world. And some of the newcomers are thinking, keep going. I feel like I'm going to puke. I'm telling you, I was there. I was there just right with you. I saw those speakers, and I thought, yeah, easy for you. You suited up dork. What would you know about where I am? What do you know of the pain or the fact that I'm a loser or I didn't complete this or didn't do that? And I'm telling you, as long as you're moving toward that picture in your life, all you're going to have is chaos and madness and blackness in your life. And what you need to do is get a picture of somebody who is doing it, get a picture in your mind clearly of what's possible for you, and start to move toward that thing. Let go of those old ideas. Bill said, join us on the road as we trudge this road of happy destiny. It's an amazing thing, you know, when you're an Alcoholics Anonymous, and Alcoholics Anonymous is in you. And you go all these places, and there's all these faces, and you don't know them, but you know that they're all just like you. It's an amazing reality, isn't it? I can get off an airplane in Amsterdam, and some drunk named Flying Bob picks me up and takes me all over the city, parks up on the sidewalks. Why? Because I'm a drunk. That's why. What are they going to do about it? And I go to England, and I go to Paris, and you're all the same. Everywhere we go, we have this common disorder called alcoholism. And we have common language and common purpose. And it's all there for you. And all you have to do is just not drink today. Just until midnight tonight. This is how it started for me and for every other person in this room. Just do these simple things. Pick up these simple spiritual tools. Let somebody tell you the truth about yourself. And join us. It's a great place to live and to die. I've seen some people die in Alcoholics Anonymous too. And it's a wonderful thing to see somebody go home happy. It's a terrible thing to watch somebody in a one-car funeral die with no family and no hope simply because they wouldn't let go of some old ideas. So kind of a serious message for a Saturday night. But I never, ever get to control what I say. It's an amazing thing. God sometimes says to me, you can be funny. And sometimes he says to me, I'll put a couple of horns in the middle, but the rest of it, buddy, for you tonight. It's going to be serious because there must be somebody here in that place tonight. And if it's you, take it and do with it as you will. Let me thank the committee for asking Shirley and I here. Let me thank you for my sobriety. I'll have another day thanks to you. We're going to go from here to Las Vegas. This is a miracle in itself. I'm taking my Norwegian mother-in-law. There is no amount of money she can spend or anything she can do that will offend me. I'm going to spoil her rotten. I am going to spoil her beyond her wildest dreams. And you guys made all of that possible. Thank you and good night.